case, which is All M's versus 7-Eleven, Mr. Ocal.
May it please the Court, Tim Ocal appearing on behalf of All EMS Incorporated, Mike Wagde and Susan Wagde, who I'll collectively refer to as the Wagdes during the course of this argument. This is a case that began actually nearly 9 years ago in September of 1996 when the Wagdes proceeded to file a complaint in the Circuit Court of Cook County seeking to protect their rights under the 7-Eleven franchise agreement by way of an action for specific performance, accounting, and other relief. That was based upon a notice of termination charging the Wagdes with underreporting retail selling prices. The case was removed to the district court at the request of 7-Eleven, and thereafter it evolved with the filing of several amended counterclaims by 7-Eleven, now charging the Wagdes with failure or a breach of the store franchise agreement for failure to maintain minimum net equity requirements.
And what are you looking for in the way of relief?
What I'm looking for here, Judge, is to we believe that the ruling of the district court.
No, what do you want in relief? The case. You obviously want a reversal. What do you want by way of an outcome of the litigation?
Outcome of litigation, Judge. I think that the there should be a finding that the Wagdes, in fact,
that's not a relief. Is not a finding.
What outcome
do you want?
The outcome: the Wagdes should be in their store. The net worth requirement should be reinstored to at least the $10,000 minimum level. They are members of a class action settlement, which entitles them to extend the store franchise agreement for another 10 or perhaps 15 years. Those are all the rights that they would lose as a result of the judgment entered in this case. So the bottom line is we want the Wagdes restored to the store.
Do you want damages also?
Judge, under the Franchise Disclosure Act, Illinois Franchise Disclosure Act, we are clearly entitled to award of attorney's fees and costs. So we would ask that all attorney's fees and costs incurred by the Wagdes.
But do you want damages? Are you asking for damages?
Well, the damages, yes, we are, in the sense that to the extent that 7-Eleven took money from the Wagdes, or the Wagdes lost money, which according to Mike Wagdes' testimony was upwards of around $150,000 between all the sales that were lost, as direct sales, associated sales, wrongful interest charges, disputed accounting charges that were never cleared up by 7-Eleven, we would be looking for monetary damages of in that particular amount. So there are several aspects to this particular case. What brings us to before this court is the fact that while we did have a jury trial in this case in May and June of 2000, which resulted in a hung jury, that was a jury trial on both the claim of the Wagdes and the claim of 7-Eleven. The case was bifurcated in April of 2004 with the consent of the parties, but the district court then proceeded to enter a judgment disposing of the entire case, even though there was no evidence allowed to be introduced on issues raised in the Wagdes' original complaint.
Could I ask you something about that, Mr. Ocal? Because it seemed to me, trying to understand your position, that it's basically that the district court failed to realize that at the end of the day, whatever happened in 1996 had to be resolved. Either 7-Eleven was correct and the Wagdes had fallen below the mark in 1996, or the Wagdes were correct and this whole ball got rolling in the wrong way. The district court makes the statement at one point that All EMS does not deny that it had a negative $55,000 in some net worth, and that 7-Eleven credited them with the $11,013. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I thought that your point was that the district court really started from the wrong place and needed to go back and figure out what happened in 96. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor, because the fact of the matter is the district court did rule or believe that the Wagdes got a credit for the $11,013.52. It didn't make any reference to the interest that's been charged on that amount since September of 1996. But the fact of the matter is they were never given such a credit. There's nothing in the record with respect to such a credit. And indeed, even in closing arguments in April 26, 2004, counsel for 7-Eleven himself brought up those particular credits that should be deducted, and yet the district court never took that into account.
And I thought it was further your position that that actually swings it around, that if that credit, in fact, had been made, the WAGDIs would have gotten themselves back in good standing in a timely fashion.
That is correct, Your Honor. Mr. Johnson testified in his examination that in September of 1996, the WAGDI's net worth would have been in excess of $14,000, well above the $10,000 minimum, and applying those credits, as set forth in my brief, as of March 13, 2002, when that notice of breach was issued by 7-Eleven, instead of having a $55,000 deficit net worth, the WAGDI's would have had a positive net worth of at least $16,000 or more.
And that's so the district court was wrong to assume that maybe an independent violation, even giving the WAGDIs all the benefit of the doubt as to 1996, they were still below the 10,000. That's essentially, as I understand it, what the district court thinks.
That is correct.
Okay.
And that's where we think the district court erred. We've set forth in our brief at pages 33 and 35 the actual mathematical calculations that show how the net worth would have been and should have been at least $16,000 or more as of March 13, 2002. And that's the trigger date because that's notice of a breach that was issued, and that was what the 7-Eleven relied upon at trial. But the district court, when the district court ruled that the WAGDIs had fallen below the $10,000 minimum level, I don't have a problem with that. The problem is that the district court went on to say that fact alone was grounds to terminate the franchise. And that's simply wrong for two fundamental reasons. One, it's wrong because it's contrary to the store franchise agreement and the customary operation of the 7-Eleven franchise system as set forth in the administration manual, which is WAGDI's Exhibit 45. The fact is that it was, according to Mr. Johnston, it's a customary, it's not, or I should say, not at all unusual for a franchise to fall below the $10,000 minimum level. In fact, he testified at page 63 in the transcript that he said this in the trial, that as of the month before March of 2004, 15 to 20 stores out of the 71 in his market were below net equity. The net equity fluctuates. That's not the point. The point is that after the net worth falls below a certain level, certain administrative procedures are triggered by the Franchise Agreement Administration Manual. They weren't followed in this particular case. Letters of notification, verbal counseling. There was a notice of breach issued in March of 2002, but the fact of the matter is...
Well, I've lost the thread. What is this $11,000 credit you're talking about?
The $11,000 credit, in September of 1996, the notice of breach was issued by 7-Eleven charging the WAGDIs with underreporting $29,000 in retail selling prices. And through the mathematics of 7-Eleven that appears in Exhibit, I'm looking at it in Exhibit, actually it's page Exhibit 14 in our appendix, as a result of their calculations, a $29,000 underreporting in retail sales translates to, and when that was charged against their account, it translated to an actual deduction from their net equity of $11,013.52. So in September of 1996, 7-Eleven wiped...
I don't understand. A $29,000... How did that become an $11,000 credit?
If you look at WAGDI Exhibit 96, which is a document produced by 7-Eleven, it's entitled Review of January 24 Breach Termination Notice, Effect of Understating Reported Retail Selling Prices on Net Worth. They come through a bunch of calculations where they put in, have to convert retail prices to cost using a VIP, variable inventory percentage factor. They include the 7-Eleven charge percentage is 52%. The windup is it comes down to $11,013.52. We don't dispute that particular calculation. But by the way, when the court...
Look, better not get into by the way. It's better stick to the...
Certainly.
Because it's very confusing. It's very confused. I have very little idea what's
going on. I apologize, Your Honor. If the court looks at Exhibit 14...
So what are you saying? $11,000, is that 7-Eleven's figure?
That's 7-Eleven's figure. We don't disagree with that particular figure.
Well, in the sense... I mean, just to be clear, there's the allegation that you were underreporting the retail prices. When you work that through the system, you come up with $11,000 at 7-Eleven and some, you know, that 7-Eleven was entitled to. So they subtract that from your net worth.
That is correct.
And that is the dispute, since, as I understand it, the WAGDI's position has always been, no, we didn't do that.
That's correct.
I don't know who did what, but that dispute never got resolved. Had it gotten resolved, it would either have been clear that the WAGDI's should lose the franchise because they were 11,000 and some short, or it should be clear that 7-Eleven has to let the WAGDI's keep it.
That is correct. And part of
our... But we don't know whether there was underreporting to begin with, so we don't know if the 11,000 should have been subtracted.
That is correct. That issue didn't go to trial in April of 2004.
Okay.
And so what is the most important factual question on which that on which the matter turns? Is it the freezers? Is it the cigarette money or what? What's the most important?
Well,
what's your strongest argument?
I would say the strongest argument, Your Honor, is the fact that when the district court came up with this calculation of $2,700 using the $55,000 deficit figure that appears in the March 13, 2002 notice of breach, the math was clearly wrong because the district court did not take into consideration the $11,013.52 that had been pooled out in September or all the interest that had been charged on $11,000 since September of 1996. So the judge's, the district court's math from the get-go was wrong. And applying the correct
right,
math.
So one
that's
point
one
is
point.
You say there's a miscalculation. What else?
The second point,
you
Your Honor, is that with respect to the losses that the district court found the WAGDI's had sustained, Anderson computed $52,691.25, but that didn't take into account, for example, disputed charges submitted to the accounting department on information request, which was another $8,200. Plus interest on those disputed charges that were going back, being assessed since January or November of 1998. It didn't take into account the money order machine that was out of the store, the phone card machine that was out of the store. It didn't take into account other damages, for example.
Now, do those relate to your damages claim, or does that relate to this net worth issue?
Well, it relates to that relates kind of in a both sense, because the damages caused to the WAGDI's reduced their caused losses to their net worth. So it basically cuts both ways. The other aspect, which wasn't taken into consideration, is that the WAGDI's pay 50.
What did they do? What did 7-Eleven do that made you lose money that forced you or might have forced you, but for the arithmetical error, might have forced you below the $10,000?
Starting with the freezer equipment that should have been replaced, at least in March.
Well, wait, didn't you have the responsibility to maintain the freezers?
Yes, and my client paid every month a maintenance fee under maintenance contract, and their freezers couldn't be repaired. They were just beyond useful life. In fact, when Mr. Helfer and Cheryl Whitaker came out finally to the store in October of 2001.
Okay, so what did the district court say about whether the freezers were beyond repair?
The district court, the damages that the district court calculated of $52,000 includes losses as a result of the freezer. So the district
rules for you on
the
freezer.
The district court ruled for me in that regard.
So why are you complaining about it?
I'm not complaining about it.
I'm asking you. Look, I asked you, what is it that you're complaining about and what the judge did? And you said arithmetical error. That's fine. And then I thought you were saying something about the freezers.
No, Judge. What I was saying is that the damages that the district court did calculate did not go far enough.
No, but I'm not... Forget that. Look, the critical question... The damages are important, of course, but the critical question is this $10,000. So my question is the only mistake you think the judge made about the net worth violation, was he was an arithmetical error, or did he make other errors as well?
He made other errors.
Well, that's what I'm asking you about. So what's another error? It's not the freezers.
Right. No, the other error is that... the WAGDI's have submitted information requests because they disputed certain charges made to the accounting department. One was for an inventory variation and other items. They submitted those information requests as required by policy and procedure. They were never taken care of by 7-Eleven. That amounts to another $8,200, and the problem with that is that when those...
So what did the judge say about that?
The judge didn't say anything. Never even discussed it, never brought it up. In addition, on top of that... Because those are charges against net worth, they become a part of the loan payable account. Interest is assessed on that $8,200 going back several years. The district court never addressed that. In addition, Mr. Wagyu testified, undisputed, that the money order machine had been taken out in September of 1996. That was because 7-Eleven came in to try to take the store away from it.
Did you ever file a post-trial motion pointing out all of these problems to the district court?
We did.
And what did the district court do with your post-trial motion?
I believe it was denied. I'm trying to remember. There were motions that were filed that weren't even ruled upon in that particular matter. I believe that motion was overall denied. We brought up, I should point out, we brought up an additional motion, a post-trial motion. The trial was in April of 2004. We brought up a motion in June of 2004 attaching as an exhibit, because there was an issue concerning cigarettes and cigarette shelving. We attached an exhibit to show that in June 17th of 2004, after the trial had been conducted, after 7-Eleven's witness had said that all the shelving was in the store, lo and behold, all the cigarette shelving that was necessary with cigarette promotions was delivered in June of 2004. The court never ruled on that motion. That particular post-trial, the court never ruled on that motion. 7-Eleven never filed a response to that motion.
I guess my major problem as I sit here is trying to distinguish between those areas where you think there's the district court was clearly erroneous in its fact-finding and those areas where you're trying to retry your case.
Well, we want a trial on a case in terms of the complaint that was originally brought on the issue of underreporting, because there was never a trial.
But you agreed to let the 2000, 2001, 2002 issues go first to the court, didn't you?
It was the request or the suggestion of Judge Anderson that would be the best way to proceed.
Right, and you agreed.
Yes, yes.
And you're just saying the scope of your agreement didn't include 96?
That's correct. That's correct. In fact, I believe the record reflects, even counsel for 7-Eleven acknowledged, when I brought a motion for directed finding on the amended counterclaim, that motion was never ruled upon. It was taken under advisement because Judge Anderson acknowledged that the case had been bifurcated and we were going to go to a bench trial only on the issue concerning net worth.
Now, what is your response to the claim that you're the author of your own problems because your clients took these large draws?
The large draws are not large draws. The draws that the Wagdies took was $600 gross per week from the store. The other draws that were taken, I believe, in the amount of, say, $350, were additional draws for a manager in the store, is what Mr. Wagdy testified to. The exhibit that was introduced into evidence showed that this particular store has gross sales in excess of $1 million. And the percentage of payroll to the gross sales of the store was never at any time out of line, given the sales in the store. The more sales you have means more customers you have, means more work you have to do, more clerks, this, that, and the other. But the fact is, the percentage of payroll to gross sales.
But they were increasing their draw at the time that they were that they were losing money.
No, Your Honor, respectfully, the Wagdies themselves never received any more than $600. There was $350 in additional draws that were taken. That was actually additional money paid to the manager who was brought into the store because of the work the Wagdies were doing in trying to improve the overall store, which involved retail sales.
Mm-hmm. Want to save your time for rebuttal?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, thanks. Mr. Moore?
May it please the Court, my name is Kevin Moore. I'm here on behalf of 7-Eleven. And this appeal does not present any sort of tantalizing legal argument. It's a fact-based appeal in which the facts are essentially undisputed. There was a provision in this franchise.
The facts seem to be quite disputed, I have to say. Could you answer a really simple question for me, going back to these draws? As I understand it, when there is this kind of franchise relationship between 7-Eleven and a particular operator of a store, there is functionally an account that 7-Eleven maintains into which the money goes, and then 7-Eleven keeps its part, and there's the 48% for the franchisee, and then the expenses get paid and somehow or another. So these draws are taken from that account, right?
Yes.
So why is 7-Eleven complaining about the amount of the draws, since 7-Eleven is functionally the person who wrote the check? You know, if you only wanted somebody to have $10,000 worth of draws in a year, once they hit $10,000, whether it's July 1st or August 15th or whatever, you stop writing the checks.
Franchise agreement has two provisions that say that the draw, you are not entitled to a draw if you are in breach of the agreement.
And you kept writing the checks anyway.
Which is the essential, which is the question you're asking me. And the answer to that is that 7-Eleven will continue making those payments even though the franchisee is in deficit or beneath the 10,000 requirement, in order to give the franchisee the opportunity to cure.
Right. And so why, though? I mean, you act in your brief like this $350. The first I've ever heard that it, maybe I just wasn't paying attention, that it went to a manager, but that it was somehow unauthorized on the part of the WAGDIs. But it couldn't have happened without the cooperation, for whatever benign reasons, of 7-Eleven.
In a sense, that is very true. And those benign reasons are that we did not want the further disruption of the business to entirely cut off the stream of income to the franchisee. It is a cash-based business. We are dependent on the franchisee to report to us what is coming into the store, what is being sold, what is being realized. And it is 7-Eleven's determination not to cut the franchise off in its entirety, because any semblance of reporting would go by the wayside. And so, therefore,
after you send a notice of termination, do you continue that policy?
We do. And this is this case, yes, we do. Nationwide, we do. And this is somewhat of an aberration because it never gets to this point. My colleague pointed out that there are programs and other things that might go on. There's administrative things that should be done to allow them to cure. Well, that was done initially. But once the termination notice was sent, and by the way, the other aspect of the termination was not only being less than that $10,000, it's the repeated breaches of the franchise agreement, some of which were willful. So once that point was reached and the termination notice sent, there was no longer any sort of need to put them on any programs, a budget, or anything else. They're never offered a budget when they're in a deficit, which is a little bit, you know, to say that the draws went to managers is news to the court. It was news to me. I didn't hear testimony to that. But the fact is that we do continue to make those payments with, I guess you would say, our cooperation in order to have a convenience store with our signs still looking at least like a 7-Eleven.
So is this, legally, how would you characterize the 7-Eleven's behavior after it sends the notice of termination? Is that do you view the contract as partially breached at that point, or are you mitigating damages? What really is your legal position?
Our legal position is that there is a provision in the franchise agreement which states that there is no waiver. So if we were to accept some of the $10,000 or the deficit that was missing, but not all of it, that would not mean that all went by the wayside. It would also mean that in continuing to make the payments, the draws, we are not waiving the conduct which led to the material breaches otherwise.
What do you consider to be your obligations, though, after you have served a notice of termination, for instance, with respect to the freezers or with respect to the presence of a field consultant? Do you still have an obligation to your franchisee after the notice of termination?
Strictly speaking, no.
Why do you do it then? What is the purpose?
We do.
You did send a field consultant for a while, and who noticed seven months later, the condition of the freezers.
Right. We do it for the other franchisees, that we have an obligation to protect our goodwill. We are not going to breach the peace. So when a termination notice is served on a franchisee and they refuse to leave, we don't march in and take our signs out, take our cups out, or other things.
Sounds like almost an attempt to mitigate damage.
And it is also an attempt to mitigate damages. If we were to allow the store to flounder, there would be health violations, as there were here. There would be other things that would hurt our goodwill. And so, therefore, in a larger picture, what we do is we continue to honor each of the obligations that are in that agreement. There is a provision in the agreement that allows us to cut off financing. So we could have invoked that provision and said, we no longer are going to honor your invoices from the vendors, we no longer are going to process your payroll, pay the taxes, and other things, and completely cut them off, which would have been well within our rights. And for business reasons, we did not do that. We did not waive, however, any claims we had that they had breached the franchise agreement and terminated it.
Can I ask you whether putting wholly to one side the net worth point and anything kind of derivative of it, does the record show independent reasons why 7-Eleven wanted to terminate this franchise?
Back in 1996, and I'll keep this as short as I can, there was this misreporting issue, and essentially it came down to a customer coming in, being charged $2 for a gallon of milk, and we were told it was only $1.50. They were allowed to keep this additional money, which contractually we had a claim to, at least 52%.
Right, and that's what I understand was subject to the first trial that ended in mistrial, but that didn't get resolved.
That was the last of a series of breaches that led up to it, and that was a concerted, willful breach that led to the determination that we no longer wanted them as franchisees.
All right, now I understand that's 7-Eleven's position, but is there a judicial finding of fact that that happened?
No.
Okay.
And the reason being, which is not entirely clear, I know, we were itching for a trial. We had two trials set that on the eve of trial were postponed, each of which resulted in a year delay. And because a forcible entry is a summary proceeding, we were very much interested in getting this into trial quickly. And that's why with every month when the deficit would increase, we did not serve additional notices. It's like beating a dead horse, and we didn't want to have a flurry of discovery for each of those notices. At some point, there were two developments. Judge Anderson suggested that we bifurcate is not necessarily the right term. Judge Anderson suggested that we limit the second trial to the net equity issue, which is much more closely defined than this misreporting in which we had to reconstruct 2 years' worth of sales. And secondly, the franchisee agreed to waive a jury trial for the second.
But here's where I got troubled, because Judge Anderson says that 7-Eleven agreed to credit all EMS with that $11,013, but that actually isn't correct. And as Mr. Ockel was explaining, if hypothetically, you know, if there had been a trial on this underreporting, and the Wogdys had won, then the $11,000 goes back into their account. If 7-Eleven had been able to show, you know, that they were being told it was $1.50 for a gallon of milk and it was really two and all of that, then clearly everything else falls into place. But isn't it wrong to assume that this was a given fact?
It was no, because it was not credited.
He thinks it was credited.
No, I just got it backwards.
Okay.
It was credited. They are taking the position
Mr.
that it
Ockel
was not
says
credited.
It wasn't credited.
It is credited.
How are we supposed to figure that out?
It is because it's in writing, and it's credited for damages purposes. On each of the notices that we served on the Wogdys, 7-Eleven acknowledged that there was this dispute from the 96 misreporting issue. And we said, therefore, we will, for purposes of curing only, for
right,
paying in
that
which is necessary in order to get you into compliance on the one net equity issue, we will give you a credit of that $11,000. And that is in each of the notices. And also, had they never reached a $10,000 limit. The only time they ever...
But Judge Anderson said... I mean, Mr. Ockel said that Judge Anderson made an arithmetical miscalculation in entering the $11,000 and computing, you know, whether all M's had gone below the $10,000.
And he did not, because what Judge Anderson used was the modified number we had used in the notices, giving them that $11,000 credit. In pages 24 to 25 of my brief, I relate in January of 2000, the only time the franchisee made any payments in an attempt to cure. And what happened was initially we told them that they had to pay $14,000 in change in which to cure, but then we realized that that would only bring them up to a zero position. So we sent them immediately a second notice saying, no, it's not $14,000, it's $24,000. After that, they submitted to the court a check for $14,000, that first figure, which they offered to put into escrow, not to pay into 7-Eleven. So 7-Eleven did not accept that. And then there was another $301 payment, which didn't get them anywhere near the $10,000. And then way too late, later in February, there was yet another payment. But that did not get them above, and that's when they turn to these information requests, which they claim went unanswered, to say that's how we make up the difference, that's how we get above the 10,000. The very exhibit that they point to show these information requests have 7-Eleven's responses in them. One of them was a $9,400 mistake that came about when a clerk in the store accepted $900 in a milk delivery, booked it somehow as $9,400, and the franchisee brought that to 7-Eleven's attention, and an adjustment was made right away. They were given dollar-for-dollar credit back for the mistake that was made, and that's documented in the very exhibit they point to say all these things went unanswered.
I just found your presentation on 24-25 very confusing, actually.
Yes.
I apologize for that.
You say the amount of the deficit with all adjustments was -$8,339.24.
That would be the $11,000 adjustment.
No. Then you say from this is added, which is an odd way of putting it, $11,013. And then you come back up again with a deficit of positive $8,000, but a
No, I'm sorry. It should not be a positive. And that's just...
Are you just saying
written,
how you got to $8,339 as... Because there's one thing that would be a deficit. Another thing would be the amount below $10,000.
No, that's a carelessly written passage.
It's
a deficit of positive $8,300. I mean to say that it was negative $8,300. And what I'm doing is repeating...
Is it a negative deficit a positive or
I think
a negative
it might number? Be, yes. So
they were almost $20,000 below where they should have
$23,000, I think. When
so
they
should
started.
Have had plus $10,000 in the account. And you're saying they went below zero and had minus?
Yes. When the January 2001 notice is based on a deficit figure less than zero of $23,859. And then they paid $14,000 in on the 27th, or attempted to, and they never paid it in. They offered to put it into
but,
escrow.
But, you know, this number...
So you added the 11,000... The 11,000 added to the negative 8,000 would bring them up to about $2,700 positive. But below, this, of course, still it's still 10,000.
No, I'm sorry. 10. The 11,000 added to the negative 23 brings them the 11,000.
Look, I mean, this is just
the 11,000 there?
Because why should the number be 8339.24 with a minus sign in front of it, and then at the top of the next page, coincidentally, 8339.24 with a plus sign on it as you're moving up toward $10,000? You know, the way you're handling this $11,000 is inconsistent, I think.
I apologize for the way I've written it. I understand that it is confusing, but if you take the deficit position, starting with the notice, which is how we apprise them of what it was, and you add in the $11,000, which
is... Well, so now, wait, where do we start where they have a negative net worth of $8,300? Is that where we start?
No, we start at negative 23. That was their...
That number's nowhere in your brief on this page.
That's true. The
deficit... But you said the amount of the deficit was minus $8,300.
With
can't
the adjustments already
there?
Being made, with
pardon?
The adjustment, with the adjustment already having been made for the 96 misreporting of prices, we come up to 83.
Okay, so what happens next? What is the $11,000 is a credit you give them?
Yes,
right?
For damage purposes.
Well, if
only.
You added $11,000 to the minus $8,300, then you come up to almost $2,700. So why wouldn't that be their net worth after this calculation?
The negative doesn't. The deficit is not at this point 83. I wrote that saying once the adjustments are made, it's at 83. Then I go on to the paragraph awkwardly. So
no, but you said from this or to this or whatever you meant, from this 8,300 is added 11,000. That implies that, you know, we have a arithmetical operation involving these two numbers.
Right. And I apologize.
Now, presumably, when you add the two numbers, you get, right, $2,700.
What I meant to write there, and I apologize for the confusion, and what is clear from the exhibits and the record and the evidence is that the deficit in January of 2000, stipulated to by the franchisees, was a negative $23,000 figure. If you add into that the $11,000, which we were crediting for damages purposes only, not liability, but damages purposes only, and then also add in the 44.
Well, before you do that, so when you just do that, you have now a negative net worth of $11,000 negative?
Right. Round figures, yes.
So at that point, they're $21,000 under the required $10,000.
Yes.
Right.
Right.
And then what happened?
And then you add in $4,400, which was the interest compounded for that $11,000.
So that's for them. Okay, so now you've pushed down the deficit
even
around $16,000.
Right. And then you add in, for purposes of crediting an attempt they made, not they didn't cure it by giving us the money. They said, we'll throw it into escrow. But giving them credit for that attempt, you add in an additional $14,210, which was deposited with the clerk of the district court and never negotiated. And then they timely submitted another $301, which brought the balance to a positive $6,172. Too late for cure purposes. They submitted an additional $2,700.
Right, but you're saying it's still below $10,000.
And it is still below $10,000. And it is wrong to say, which is how we started down this road, that $11,000 was never credited. It was, and it's clearly in writing. It's certainly more clearly in the notice than it is in my brief. But it's in the record, it's in the exhibit, it's in the argument, and Judge Anderson took it into consideration properly. I began by saying there's not disputed factual issues, and I'm not sure that that was well accepted at face value. There is a provision in this franchise agreement that maintains $10,000 must be kept in that open account. There is no question that these franchisees during the long term of this lawsuit never achieved that mark. We had a trial because their defense was 7-Eleven had somehow thwarted their performance under the franchise agreement. In order to avail themselves of that, we would have had to make performance impossible. Judge Posner, you asked at the beginning, what are you looking for of the franchisees if things were to go their way in this appeal? Their remedy, if they were to establish that we had materially or substantially thwarted their performance under the agreement, was either to rescind and sue for damages, maybe file an injunctive measure asking that 7-Eleven be kept from doing those things that is thwarting their performance, not a more broad injunctive action that says you can't terminate it under any conditions. They have taken the position that if there is anything in the 2,700 items that are sold in these convenience stores that we can point to, whether there's evidence of it or not, if we can point to it and say that somehow 7-Eleven let us down in that regard, one of the 2,700 items, their position is that all bets are off. They no longer have to abide by any of the provisions in the franchise agreement. Their relief, if they were to prevail, would be a rescission of the contract, and that's it, as if the contract never existed.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Moore. And Mr. O'Kyle, how much time does he have? 2 minutes?
Addressing counsel's argument, I find it curious that 7-Eleven can say that after it issued a notice of breach in September of 1996, which of course was never litigated
Well, let's look at 24 and 25. So Mr. Moore took us through that, and certainly it looks as if he credited you with the $11,000. What's the problem?
I can point to the court this. Judge Anderson did not contradict.
Look, I'm asking you about 24 and 25.
Yes, Judge.
What is wrong with the
pages 8 and 9.
Please look at 24 and 25 and tell of his brief and tell me what is wrong with that.
The original deficit, or the original amount of money that the Watkins would have to pay in at that point in time would have been, I believe, approximately $33,000. From that, you have to take out the $11,013.52, subtract from that $4,446.93, subtract from that $14,210.84. Subtract from that $301.28. Those are the sums that were paid by the WAGDIs, the $14,300, as of January 27th and February 3rd, which, by the way, 7-Eleven's own...
Don't by the ways.
I'm sorry, Judge. 7-Eleven's internal records show that those checks were received and negotiated by 7-Eleven. That would leave a net worth, a positive net worth, of the WAGDIs at that particular time of at least $6,112.81. That's not taking into consideration the district court's findings concerning losses to net worth caused by the freezer problem and everything else. What they don't take into consideration is that at that particular point in time, this was pointed out in my reply brief at pages 9 and 10, is the fact that the WAGDIs, following the rules of 7-Eleven, though 7-Eleven apparently chose it didn't feel it needed to, they followed the rules of the administration manual. They submitted information requests that go back to 1998, which hadn't been resolved yet. Those information requests, as of January of 2000, totaled $7,752.05. So you have to add, under the administration manual, they can't issue the notice of breach if there's outstanding information requests that are not yet resolved. They can't do that. They're not supposed to do that, but they did it anyway. If you add in the $7,000 figure to the $6,000 figure, the WAGDIs had a net worth in January after they made these payments in excess of $14,000, and they made another payment in February of $2,000.
Okay, let me ask you another. All right, so we have to check into that, what you said on pages 9 to 10. But let me just ask you about the last point that Mr. Moore made. When you seek to, have they taken the store away? You know, we denied that stay, or what is that?
As of this moment, they have not taken the store away. We filed a motion to extend the time for filing a bond or reconsider it to the point to the oral
that.
Argument.
Yeah, didn't we?
I believe that motion is still pending.
Or is it still pending?
Yes.
Okay. So, but what he says is that that you want to keep the store, but you don't want to comply with the terms of the franchise?
That's not true, Your Honor. We've been paying 52% of the gross profit every month.
But, I mean, so you understand, if you want to keep the store, you have to pay. You have to maintain the $10,000...
Absolutely. Absolutely. And on that particular point, this is very important, Your Honor. At page Exhibit 7 in our appendix, and it's also in 7-Eleven's appendix, is the March 13, 2002 notice of breach. Because counsel said that Judge Anderson took the $11,000 in the interest and credit, or took that into consideration. He did not. If the court looks at the decision of Judge Anderson, his starting figure is $55,422.79. That number appears at paragraph 3 of the March 13, 2002 notice. And if you look at paragraph 6 of the March 13, 2002 notice, you'll see that 7-Eleven itself says that the deficit, after giving credit for the underreporting dispute, which remains unresolved, the WAGDIs would reduce the deficit from $55,000 to $45,773.87. Mr. Johnson himself admitted that that number was wrong because that notice, at paragraph 6, says that the effect of the underreporting reduced net equity by $9,600. It did not. 7-Eleven's own calculations, which were not produced to us until April of 2000, on an accounting action filed in September of 1996, show that the reduction in net worth was at least $11,013. And additionally, finally, that figure, March 13, 2002 notice of breach, takes no consideration whatsoever for the admission by Mr. Johnston at trial in April of 2004 that interest had been charged on that $11,000 going back to September of 1996. We never heard about that interest until the day Mr. Johnson took the stand in April of 2004, despite the fact that we were asking for an accounting since September of 1996.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Oco and Mr. Moore.
Thank you.
We'll move on to the next